Good morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, construction work continues apace here on the Christ Cathedral campus, specifically on Christ Cathedral itself, one of the most ambitious, unique, and creative renovations of any church anywhere. The task of turning one of the most famous and visible buildings of the world into a Catholic worship space has fallen largely to the man we have on the phone visiting with us today, Scott Johnson. He is a partner in the Johnson Fain Architectural, Interior, and Urban Planning Firm. He's going to give us an overview of plans for the cathedral and a bit of an update on what's been going on there lately. Scott, welcome, and thanks so much for being with us on the show today.
Thank you, Pat. Happy to be there.
Well, we're still 2 years away from the completion of the renovation of Christ Cathedral, but anyone who visits the campus is going to see and likely hear a lot of activity going on. There are barriers up in front of all the ground floor access areas to the cathedral, so it's not really possible for a passerby to see inside. But if they could right now, what would they see?
Well, they would see all the interior, we'll call them movables or furnishings, removed. The original dais or lectern is gone. The organ has been taken out of the space, boxed, and for the most part shipped to Italy, where it's being completely refitted and updated. And they'd see one big, enormous room with no parts and pieces.
It is one of the most cavernous spaces right now I think a lot of people would ever see. If anyone had been to the building back when it was known as the Crystal Cathedral, I think they'd be amazed to see all of that stuff gone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what's interesting about it is that the level of changes that we're going to make on the way you experience the inside of the volume or the building shell are quite extreme, quite enormous. So it's actually, I don't know what it takes to get in, but it would be very interesting for viewers to see it now while it's quite empty. They will, of course, remember what it was before as Crystal Cathedral, and then 2 years and some from now, they'll see it completely remade on the inside. Quite an interesting progress.
Before we get into specific aspects of the project, let's talk in a little more general terms about how the overall design concept, I guess you'd call it, was decided upon. You had to start out with a set of imperatives for a Catholic worship space, elements that had to be included because this was going to be a specifically Catholic worship space. Did you start with that and, in a sense, work your way out, or did you come up with a grand design and then figure out how to work all those specific liturgical elements into it?
Well, we do as we normally do when beginning a project of this scale and complexity, which is basically research. And while we're very familiar with Catholic churches and Catholic cathedrals, and anyone who is an architecture student at any time has spent time running around Europe and looking at beautiful cathedrals of many years ago, and then there are many more modern ones which create other kinds of innovations, other kinds of circulation patterns and volumetric ideas. But we started by researching, and we presented a wide range of alternatives of ways to reoccupy the interior of this magnificent volume, and in each case, how to play out the liturgical events that would occur, where the altar and the Eucharist would be, where the cathedral would be. We know where the organ is, how the music would be perhaps performed antiphonally in the historic fashion, where pews would be, where sight lines would be, where the processions, the many important linear processions occur. So we ended up with a wide range, maybe dozens of ideas about how to reestablish that within the perimeter confines of this building, which, of course, were given. They weren't to move around. But what happened inside, of course, could be different. And through a process of researching that, sampling really different ways of doing it, and then interacting with a committee that was given to us by Bishop Van to review our progress, and with Bishop Van himself, we came to one that seemed to be very consensual with everyone, seemed to both be powerful in terms of delivering the liturgy in the way that everyone felt it should be, but also kind of optimizing the way the existing building worked, trying to solve both of those problems in one attempt.
Was there a lot of background back and forth talk, a lot of give and take, a lot of suggestions and counter suggestions as the planning went on? Or did things proceed along pretty smoothly? Did you find a lot of agreement about things between your firm and the diocese and all the planners?
Well, to that question, actually, I want to give a complicated answer. I want to say yes and yes, which is to say that everyone is very opinionated. The emissaries of the cathedral are extremely knowledgeable about the liturgy and the various ways it can be and is sometimes played out and what the preferences here might be. And while we know some things about Catholic liturgy, they know considerably more, and they were, I have to add, very generous and patient with us as we went through different scenario planning events. So they had different opinions, but it was all extremely congenial. We have enormous respect for them. They had, I'm happy to say, rather high respect for us. So it was, everyone was really operating in the areas that they're good at, I guess I would say, and they were knowledgeable about, and it was a very, very happy team. So while there were vigorous conversations and personal preferences could be talked about in the group in passion, still the process was extraordinarily consensual, and I was talking earlier about multiple essential concepts. We really came to an essential concept very quickly, and then a lot of the variations on a theme and what if and what if, what if we did that, what if we did that, that very animated kind of conversation, those are really just subsets and details within the overall concept. And those continued, but they never were personal. They never were anything that slowed the progress. So we do many projects of scale and complexity, and this was a pleasure, believe me.
I think a lot of people would call that creativity.
Yes, hope so, yes.
Well, the diocese has always acknowledged a debt of gratitude that it owes to the Reverend Robert Schuller and his inspiration in building the original cathedral. Of course, Reverend Schuller passed away last week. His vision and the vision of the original architect, Philip Johnson, will still be seen in the transformation, I imagine.
Yes, I think maybe two things on that, Pat. I think that the Bishop Van and the Catholic Diocese appreciated the generosity and their common faith, frankly, in Reverend Schuller making it so that the Catholic Church could take it over. I think the bishop has always been generous and grateful and credited Reverend Schuller with that. And I think, in a sense, he and they are returning the generosity. I think we watch that as architects and designers, and we see it. It's like watching your parents having good behavior. It sort of models what you better do or what you should do. And by seeing that that relationship as it was, I think it behooves us as designers to both then in our realm, which is the physical realm, to both be gentle and thoughtful about the original building, to honor it for what it was and give it credit, be neighborly with it, at the same time take it on in our own time under our own charge and make it work as perfectly as we can in the way it needs to today, without harming anything of the virtue and the value that it has as a building that was conceived 30 years ago. So that's our charge. We went about it with that mindset, and we hope that everyone who visits it feels that we performed properly.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Scott Johnson. He is a partner in the Johnson Fain Architectural Interior and Urban Planning Firm, one of the principal entities who is working on the renovation of Christ Cathedral. In the couple of minutes we have left in the segment here, tell me a little bit about the difference between what the cathedral will become and what it was. The original cathedral was, I think it's safe to say, made for TV. It was made for the Hour of Power. The new design is not. What would you say is the principal difference?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and I think it resonates for us. The Hour of Power was, of course, one of the early and extraordinarily successful teleministries, if you will, broadcast worldwide, and as such, there were aspects of it. It was one big room, much like a broadcasting soundstage might be, and it had natural light it was flooded with natural light, so the colors and the contrast were perfect for the camera, and it had a high, very broad stage, so programming of flexibility was key and was they were capable of doing all kinds of events. Camera angles were wide with multiple camera angles. So all of that was accounted for in the cathedral, in the Crystal Cathedral. And, of course, it was because of Reverend Schiller's mission. He even had, as everyone knows, historically the 90-foot-tall door that opened behind the lectern, and he could rotate around and address the cars in the parking lot, much as he had done historically. So all of those things were about his lineage and his approach. When we say, well, now we're going to design a Catholic cathedral, we're at the beginning, we were, of course, brought back to, well, gee, Catholic cathedrals, they're not flooded in light. They have, they're frequently dark and mysterious and incredibly vertical, and light comes through them as mystery. You know, it comes through a stained glass window or a rose window, and so there are bands of light, but they're dark, and they're masonry. This is kind of the history of Catholic cathedrals. They're processional. They're highly linear. The procession is an important part of the event, and, of course, the Eucharist is the centrality of the Eucharist and the altar, and the baldachin is very important. And here, that didn't exist before, so we really have to find a way to recreate all of this very important liturgical event, these liturgical events, within what before was really more of a public broadcasting worldwide space. So there are a lot of differences in the kind of intimacy we're trying to create now as a Catholic cathedral.
You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000. Please stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. We're back with Orange County Catholic Radio, and we're speaking with Scott Johnson about the renovation of Christ Cathedral. It would be easy for the structure of the cathedral to be overwhelming, the design of the cathedral, rather, to be overwhelming. What are you going to do, in a sense, to counteract that and make the experience for individuals a little more intimate? We talked just before the break about the old cathedral being made for TV, and the Reverend Schuller intended it to be spectacular and large. We're going to bring it down a little bit to a more personal level. Is that so?
Yes, that's right. And I think add detail that will make the experience more personal and more intimate. Essentially, what we're doing, Pat, is we're creating, if you will, a room within the room. The existing shell or the existing Crystal Cathedral is essentially a one-room building for 2,000 people. So it gives you a sense of the kind of scale of it, and it's quite vast. But we are going to go inside the inner liner of the shell, the glass shell of the building, and create a completely other liner, which will be made up of several thousand, I'll call them petals, like the petals of a flower. And they'll be perforated triangles, and they'll be in various degrees of openness or closeness, depending on the rotation of the sun. This issue of this inner layer, which we made up of these petals, has to do with environmental comfort. It has to do with the glare from the sun. It has to do with heat, ventilation, acoustics. It's our attempt to create a poetic solution to solve a whole myriad of technical issues. And the ground plane, I guess, very important at the entry level, the altar will be on a predella in the absolute center of the building. So if you think of the building as an elongated diamond, the altar will be at the center rather than on a basilican plan where it's at the far end and it's very long and sight lines are far away. No, this will be in the center, so the average pew and the average parishioner or visitor will be much closer to the activity on the predella at the altar. So there'll be a sense of closeness. The edges of the perimeter of the diamond or the building shell will be all lined in limestone up to the upper portion of the mezzanine, and that will be sculpted so that the sun that does pass through the ceiling and into the interior of the space will show sort of beautiful shadow lines and will articulate the sculpture of those limestone walls. The pews will all be done in walnut. They'll be hand-carved in walnut, and they will match certain portions of the walls, which will also be in walnut. And then there will be something we call streaming silver travertine, which is a paving stone, which we mine in Italy by the same people who would have mined it 2,000 years ago. And they're cutting paving slabs and then shipping them into Orange County, and we'll lay these slabs of streaming silver travertine along the floor, and they have beautiful grains in them and scale. So all the materials will have scale, kind of human scale, and all the pieces will be the size of a person. So it will be a much more intimate kind of room.
It sounds spectacular, but not overwhelming. It's going to be a real feast for the eyes, and there's going to be a lot to look at, but it isn't going to be in any sense gaudy.
That's right. I would not say, and hopefully we have expressed what Bishop Van feels is the right thing and which the committee does, but we've never wanted it to be overly ornamental or rich. We want it to be as inclusive as possible. We want the mission, if you will, of the cathedral to be clear that it's open to every member of probably the most diverse community in America, which is Orange County.
Yes.
So it needs to appeal to everybody on a very fundamental personal and physical level. It's not aimed at any part of society or any part of the world in particular.
I want to back up just a little bit. You were mentioning those petals that are going to be almost ubiquitous in the inner part of the structure. Those are called quatrefoils, are they not?
Yes, they're each triangular, but they're assembled in a square. So if you think of four triangles nested together, they make a square. And then you take that square with the four triangles, and those triangles are either in a more open position or a more closed position. And that mostly depends on where the sun is. We want to sun up high in the sky can come down and be comfortable, but sun down low in the sky, either in the morning or in the afternoon, can be looking right into you, and you're looking into the sun, and there's glare. So we've done something that Phil Johnson couldn't have done 30 years ago. Fortunately, today we can, which is we digitally map the entire surface of the building with respect to where the sun is at every hour and every day of the year, and then we designed and engineered the ceiling so those open and closed positions of the petals respond to the position of the sun and whether it would generate glare or direct sun or not. So there's quite an engineering side to the what I'd call the aesthetic side as well.
And it not only handles the old problem of light and heat, it also does a lot to handle the old problem of sound, right?
That's correct, yeah. Basically, what you want to do when sound is coming, particularly from a position within a space, here we want a fairly long duration of sound, a long period, because of the nature of the music that's sung. When someone speaks the spoken word, of course, we want a very short one, but we want to diffuse the sound throughout the 2,000 seats. So by having these pedals in various positions, we're effectively creating what in a symphony hall would be called a resonator. We're creating a whole series of reflections. Sound emanates from a location, it sprays out like a wave, and then it's reflected in multiple positions so that everyone sitting in the space hears a full spectrum of sound.
And speaking of sound, we've been talking a lot lately on this show and elsewhere about the restoration of the Hazel Wright organ. It's going to be the last thing that goes into the new cathedral before the cathedral is dedicated. And tuning it to the space is going to be, as you undoubtedly know, a very large and complicated task. But once it's up and running, what are people going to notice and what will it be able to do? I'm thinking specifically of the carillon.
Yes. It's in Italy now. It's been dismembered by the gentleman who actually built the organ in the first place, and they're wonderful people to work with. And they're cleaning it and restoring it, and then it's going to be brought back. In the meantime, we as the architects are recladding the entire casements, the millwork that is for it, respecting, of course, all the chambers and all of the flutes, and that will all be refinished and then brought back in place. This is the last thing to be done because it, frankly, is such a daunting task that it takes the longest to do. We'll essentially be able to rebuild the entire building, and they'll still be repairing and refining the organ. They bring it in at the time at which the interior is in place, and then immediately they will tune it to the audiometrics, if you will, of the room. But I think that we can have high confidence that it will have great sound. And if we've done our job right on the pedals, on the dissemination of the sound, there should be a very full and broad awareness of all ranges, high and low, from the organ. It should be quite great.
We've been talking about the first phase of the project so far. The second phase includes what is called the undercroft. people would refer to it probably as the basement, but we call it the undercroft. Tell us what that is and the most significant elements that are going to be down there.
Well, there's sort of two kinds of elements. There's certainly the sacred elements, and the building is, of course, it's a star, so there are four sides. So you might think of like a crucifix or a cross. There's the bishop's door and a narthex, which you enter from the south. On the left or the on the west is the baptismal font. To the north is the sanctuary, and to the Blessed Sacrament chapel. And to the right is the pilgrim's rotunda, and in that rotunda is a radial stair that will take us down into the basement or undercroft, and along a direct aisle or arcade will be St. Callistus Chapel. There'll be a chapel there for services for 200 people beneath the ground level of the church itself. And behind that will be the columbarium and the bishop's crypt. So there are those sacred portions of worship. And then behind that is a whole set of vesting spaces and preparatory spaces and bride's room and some service and support for the operation of the cathedral. So it's a terribly important piece. It makes it all work for us to be able to have such a clean, open, magnificent, clutter-free space for our sanctuary floor at ground level. We still need many things to happen, so those will be in the undercroft. And it reestablishes the traditional relationship of the undercroft and the bishop's crypt and columbarium below the altar, which will happen here in this building, much as it's happened for hundreds of years in Catholic cathedrals.
Not the least of which is St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
The most, maybe, incredible example, yes.
Well, in about the minute and a half we have left, I'd love to hear this, that you and your colleagues have said that working on this project was unique in your careers. What makes this so special for all of you?
Well, we do a wide range of projects, and in any project there are multiple goals, but quite honestly, in the world as it is, many of those goals have, I would say, for lack of a better word, certain commercial goals, or certain practical commercial ends that have to be accommodated. And, well, that's fine, and that's the business side. In this particular project, what a greater thrill could one have than design a spiritual space, a space that doesn't speak to the commerce of the world. It's about other things, frankly, more eternal things, things of greater gravitas and importance to everyone. And that would be your program, that would be your charge. And then to have sponsors such as we have at the cathedral and the bishop and his committee who are not thinking about the next 2 years or 5 years. They're actually thinking in decades and centuries. And it changes the entire conversation about how to design and how you go about it and what has lasting significance and what might be just momentary and what value we place on things when we make a decision. It's an important decision because someone won't, it's not a store in a mall and in 5 years someone will come in and redecorate it. It will be here in identifiable form for years and decades to come, and it needs to serve the people we know today and the people we haven't even met or aren't born yet. So it inevitably leads you into a conversation of greater profundity, and it's just a real pleasure and a real growing experience to be part of that.
Scott Johnson, many thanks for visiting with us today, and much good luck with your excellent work on the renovation of Christ Cathedral. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Pat. It's great to be with you.
This is Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000, coming to you from the campus of Christ Cathedral. We'll be right back after this. We're back, and joining us in the studio is Dr. Michael Cushing. Dr. Cushing is an Anaheim Hills-based family physician who's going to be speaking with us about California's End of Life Option Act. That's SB 128, which was introduced into the state legislature back in January and is being debated in a hearing in Sacramento today, bearing in mind, please, that we are recording this show on Tuesday, April 7th. The bill would allow physician-assisted suicide in this state, and it is very similar to a law that is currently in force in Oregon. Dr. Cushing is a faithful Catholic, so it's pretty easy to guess his position on this issue, but he brings something more visceral to the table when the discussion turns to terminal illness and end-of-life issues, in that he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2004. If you're counting, that means he has lived for more than a decade of his life with a terminal illness, notwithstanding the fact that he is in our studio now and he looks pretty terrific. First of all, Dr. Cushing, thanks so much for coming down to the studio to be with us today.
Thank you, Pat.
We're very happy to see you here, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know how you've managed to keep what can be an aggressive form of cancer at bay for the last 10 years or so.
Well, I've had some very, very good medical care. My doctors have been very generous with me and very kind to me, and I've been doing a lot of praying.
I can imagine.
Doing a lot of praying.
I can imagine. Well, let's take a look at the proposed legislation. On the face of it, the law might look to many people like it's a compassionate idea, but in your point of view, it is not. What's the fallacy there?
Well, first of all, killing somebody sounds a bit unusual to me as an act of compassion. I think that this is this bill is totally antithetical to any sense of compassion. What has happened is the folks at Compassion and Choice, the real pushers of this bill, they have worked to get people thinking of themselves in a terminal illness as a burden. And we don't want people to be a burden. We don't want you to feel like you're a burden. We would like you to be able to pick the time and the date of your demise. It gives you control. It gives you power over something that you're really powerless to. And so I think it's totally antithetical to compassion. I think it's degrading. It takes away from the dignity of the human person.
Well, what danger exists for a fairly long and very slippery slope on this issue? What will this mean for doctors, for government regulators, even for law enforcement?
Well, if you look at the law, how it's written and how it was written in Oregon, the law is not forcing doctors right now to do this. All right. It's not being mandated that doctors do this. My fear is that down the road, over time, there will become a push to mandate that doctors do this. If the patient asks for it, you have to deliver. The insurance industry, the government, they have a motive for this, okay? Your insurance companies save a lot of money when they take a terminal cancer patient or an MS patient, somebody with multiple sclerosis, or they take a patient with heart disease. And if we can convince them that their time to die has come, it will save a lot of money for the insurance companies and for the government. One reason I bring this up is that we now face over thousands, tens of thousands of people with Alzheimer's disease. This is a hugely expensive disease, and what better way than to relieve the burden on the families and to relieve the burden on the government and on society than to be able to put people down, much like you would put down your dog.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's being talked about as an expedient,
right,
and that it's being talked about in economic terms. You're never going to hear anybody, any advocate for this, say something along these lines, like, we would rather that you commit suicide. We'll be happy to pay for that rather than pay for you to be treated.
Well, that, in fact, has happened. Up in Oregon, there was a woman patient who had had breast cancer. She was refused her breast cancer treatments and pain management medicines by the insurance company. And shortly after that happened, she got a letter from the state saying, hey, we'll be happy to pay for your drugs that will allow you to commit suicide. And this is a documented story that occurred.
So it comes down to dollars and cents here. You're only going to pay a few dollars for a few pills, right, that she may have to take, rather than engaging medical personnel and time and hospital beds and everything else.
Right.
They say, hey, you're done. It's time to go.
Right.
Tick tock, tick tock.
And in fact, over time, I believe that there will also be a push to make it a duty to die. that ultimately they will be telling people, you know, you're not able to take care of yourself, you're not able to do anything for the society around you, you have become less than what we consider the norm, it's your duty to die. And we'll convince people to do that.
And they're equating value of life with productivity, which again is antithetical, yes?
Well, the whole bottom line here is that each of us, we all have our inherent natural rights. We have our inherent dignity as a human being. And to turn around and say, well, you're terminal now, you're going to die anyway, let's hasten the moment. Well, that's a wrong way to look at it, because in that process of dying, not only does the patient grow, the patient grows spiritually. The patient grows closer to family, to friends. Many things can be resolved during this time. I had a friend who just recently died from a cancer, whose family was brought closer together, had been at odds for a number of years, and they brought the family together, realizing that here, Dad's leaving. You know, Dad's leaving, Uncle's leaving, so-and-so is gone. He's going to be gone. I want to fix that fence. I want to mend it. And so there is an inherent process that goes with dying that doesn't just help the patient, the person dying. It helps the family and those who are involved with it.
And a lot of this ignores the advanced state of palliative care that's available now. It's
yes.
gotten so much better in recent years, has
Correct.
It not?
It is. And, in fact, it's a straw man argument that the folks at Compassion and Choices are throwing out in regards to the pain that just cannot be it's terrible. It's horrible. People, probably 98-99% of people can go with the pain measures that we have today. The pain can be stopped. The patient can be kept within the realm of conversation, close to family. Again, allowing family to become compassionate, helping the family to become empathetic. And, the palliative measures are there. That's a straw man argument that's being thrown out there.
Let's get a little more personal here about your own experience. You have lived with a life-threatening disease for more than a decade. Tell us a little bit about your journey through your diagnosis, your treatment, your coming to grips with the situation. Did you ever have a moment when you thought, boy, this is bad, maybe I ought to think about checking out?
There was never a moment that I thought of checking out. In fact, I didn't know who to file the complaint with. but I had this cancer thrown at me totally out of the blue. And I'm 51 years old. I've got my daughters getting ready to move on in their lives to high school, college, and things like that. And so here I am in 2005. They've taken out half my pancreas, my spleen, a few lymph nodes, and various and sundry other things out of me. And I'm sitting here, and now in retrospect, if I had been depressed enough and down enough, and this law had been in effect, what if I had done that?
Yeah.
Okay, what if I had done that and killed myself? Well, let's look at this and say, gee whiz, I would have missed two weddings. My kids graduating from grade school, high school, college. I've got a daughter graduating soon from medical school. My new third baby grandson is being born. Birthdays, family events, everything. I would have missed it. And I'm here 10 years now. And in all honesty, I believe that God has me here for a reason. And
well, again, it's a real shame that this is radio and not TV, because I wish you folks could have a look here, because this man looks like he could go out and run a marathon.
Oh.
Honestly. What have you seen as a doctor in this regard among patients or among others, other physicians' patients? I mean, tell us about some times when you've been witness to patients at the end of their lives, and what transpires that makes it worthwhile for them to be determined to see things out to the end?
Well, I've had several occasions to be with patients as they're dying, and to be with them prior to their death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a continuum. It's just... If you've been with a patient for a number of years and they're dying, it's a continuum of that physician-patient relationship. And so the opportunity to help guide them to whatever that eternity is for them. You know, they're not all Catholic. They're not all Christians. So, you know, you're going to have Buddhists and Muslims and all kinds of people. But to be there to share in this momentous event and to be there to love that patient, to have compassion and empathy, that there's no price tag you could put on that. It's valueless. I mean, it's not valueless. It's
invaluable.
Invaluable.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. And in your own situation here, I imagine right now you're not necessarily thinking out toward the end. You're thinking in the moment, right?
Well, I'm in the moment, and I'm not going to say that I don't think about it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I pray daily, and I just when I wake up in the morning and I go vertical, what a great day. It's a good start. And it's like, okay, now I've got this day in front of me. I have been blessed. And it convinces me every day that there is a God and that He's a loving God and a merciful God.
Well, Dr. Michael Cushing, many thanks for coming down to the studio to be with us today and for sharing what is surely a unique perspective on this issue. God bless you. Please stay in touch with us.
I will, Pat.
And when we come back, I have the pleasure to introduce to our listeners an old friend of mine who's going to talk about, among other things, accounting, jail, and the priesthood. Stay with us. Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm on the phone with my old friend, well, I guess I should say my friend of long standing, Father Paul Spellman. Father Paul is the pastor at St. Mark's Church in Venice. That's the Venice near Santa Monica. And our friendship goes back 20 years to when we first met on a retreat at St. John's Seminary in Camarillo. Paul, thanks so much for taking time out today to talk with us, and welcome to the show.
Great, Patrick. Thanks so much, and I appreciate you inviting me to share a few thoughts on my seminary experience and my vocation.
Well, to begin with, I'm going to let you fill in most of the details here, but when we met for the first time on that retreat back in 95, I think it was, what were we doing at St. John's?
We were actually at St. John's for a Come and See weekend. This was in 1995. I was 40. Pat was maybe 41 or 42, and we went up there as part of the vocations process, because when you're discerning the priesthood or religious life, they have monthly discernment group meetings where you meet with other men and women who are talking about the seminary and praying about the convent, and you meet with priests and you meet with other people who are involved in vocations. And then we did a silent directed retreat up at the mission in Santa Barbara, which was fabulous. And then they invited us to come up to St. John's Seminary for a come and see weekend. And we went up on Friday morning and went to a number of the classes, sat in with the seminarians, met some of the priests, and then we were there Saturday and Sunday. We got to learn about seminary life, get to know about how the seminary works. The seminary has changed a bit in the last 20 years. When I started there in August of 1995, we had single rooms with no bathrooms. Bathrooms were at one end of the hall and telephones were at the other end of the hall, so it was kind of a busy hallway there. Right now, each room has its own private bath, and just about everybody has their own cell phone and their own computer, so a lot of that has changed.
Well, the retreat, how valuable an experience was that for you? How much of a revelation was it?
Well, I think the two things that were most important about it was that I got to see what the seminary life was about. What classes are they taking? Moral theology, systematic theology, studying the scriptures, looking at liturgy and the history of the saints. I was really fascinated about all the classes that were offered. The other thing is that God gave us an opportunity to meet other seminarians, men who, like us, had been out of college or maybe just out of college, or like us, a long time out of college, but had decided or discerned that the Lord was calling us. But we wanted to talk to some other guys and say, you know what, you quit your job, moved out of your house in your late 20s, early 30s. Here I am 40 years old. I mean, is this even realistic? But after talking to a lot of the guys and hearing about their journeys, I said, you know, I really feel that this is what God is calling me to, and that's why I pursued it.
In your case, you were just about headed for Wall Street. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances that brought you to St. John's.
Well, when I went to college, my main theme in picking my major was show me the money. And I noticed that the accounting majors, exactly, the accounting majors were the ones who were getting the most job offers and the best job offers. And I'm a very analytical person. I love working with numbers. So I majored in accounting, went to work for a CPA firm called Price Waterhouse. Then I went to graduate school and got a master's degree in finance and economics. And I actually did work for a couple of years for a Wall Street firm called Kidder Peabody. I worked in their Los Angeles office. Kidder Peabody was bought out by Payne Weber. Payne Weber has since been bought out by Union Bank of Switzerland, so it doesn't exist anymore. But it was a fascinating experience. I bought my house. I actually bought a Mercedes. I was living what you'd call the good life, and I was very happy in my life, but I can't say that I was really fulfilled. And that's why I started to take a look at the seminary and really asking, God, what are you calling me to?
Well, you had a time when you were working at L.A. County Juvenile Hall, and that kind of deepened your commitment, did it not?
Absolutely. I was a volunteer in the Catholic Chaplains Program at Juvenile Hall, the one in East L.A. by the Big County USC Hospital. I was a volunteer there for 12 years. We would have mass for the youth on Sunday morning and then meet with them in small groups, and then we would go back on Wednesday evenings and meet with them individually. It was based on Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25. When I was in prison, you visited me. And the people said, Jesus, when did we see you in prison? They said, whatever you did for the least of my brothers and sisters, you did for me. And prisoners at this time are basically looked down as the least of our brothers and sisters. But what I found there was some young people who had an opportunity to go through the juvenile justice system, and then when they got out, to make some better decisions if they had the right guidance. I also volunteered with an organization in Hollywood called Covenant House, and I'm still very involved with the chaplain there, Sister Margaret Farrell. And Covenant House works with homeless kids that are living on the streets in Hollywood. We would go out in this big blue van with a white dove painted on the side and go up and down Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset Boulevard, and Santa Monica Boulevard and hand out sandwiches and hot chocolate and try and get kids off the streets. And then finally, the Sisters of St. Joseph have a home for homeless women and children called the House of Ruth in East Los Angeles. And I knew the director of that, and she was struggling with the financial reports and the financial situation. So I became the pro bono treasurer for a couple of years and sat on the board and got to meet a lot of the women and the children. And once again, seeing the face of Christ in others. So all of these things really energized me, and I had to ask God the question, why am I so energized by all of these things? Perhaps maybe you're calling me to a different direction in my life.
Well, so you decide to apply for admission to the seminary. You get admitted, and now you're at the next level. Was seminary life what you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, seminary life turned out really well. I met a lot of great guys who were in discernment, who were really discerning God's will in their lives. There were a couple of guys who went in there all of a sudden, you know, just guaranteed they were going to be priests. One guy had a license plate on his car that said priest-to-be. Another guy already had bought his own chalice and everything. And I said, wait a second. I said, this is a time of prayer and discernment and learning. And it's a 6 or 7 year process. I did it in 6 years. But I decided to take each year 1 year at a time. I committed to that year and said, no matter how good or bad it is, I'm really going to take this year and then at the end of the year discern if this is God, what God was calling me to. Well, we get into our sixth year, and then we're petitioning for holy orders, the sacrament of ordination. And I said, you know what? I said, this is exactly what I feel God is calling me to. So I petitioned for holy orders and was ordained in June of 2001.
And you actually did take a year off, though, which is not unusual.
Exactly. I was really looking at the diocesan priesthood, which you join a diocese, which is a geographic area, where it might be Los Angeles or Orange or San Diego. But I was also looking at religious orders. I had a great respect for the Jesuits because it was the Jesuits who came and celebrated Mass at Juvenile Hall each Sunday morning. I got to know a lot of the Jesuits who were at Dolores Mission who were helping at Juvenile Hall. I also had a great love for the Mary Knowles. The Mary Knowles are the international missionaries that were founded in 1912 in New York, with the idea of sending priests and nuns throughout the world to proclaim the good news of the gospel. And I still didn't have that settled in my mind. So I took the fall semester and went to the Western Jesuit School of Theology, which at the time was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's now at Chestnut Hill at Boston College. And then in the January, I went down to Bolivia. And I lived and worked in an orphanage that was run by the Mary Knoll missionaries. And I went to Cochabamba, Bolivia, because that's where the Mary Knolls had their language and cultural center. So I was able to learn some Spanish, able to learn some Latin American culture, and have a fabulous experience. But at the end of that year, I realized that God was calling me to be a priest right here at home in California. Went back to the seminary and was ordained in 2001.
For those of you just joining us, we're on the phone with Father Paul Spellman, who's the pastor at St. Mark's Church in Venice, California. He's telling us his vocation story. You've had three very different assignments since you were ordained, and they've all been really rewarding in their own way, haven't they been?
They've been fabulous. Your first assignment is always an associate pastor reporting to a pastor. No matter how much experience you have or education, you always start off as an associate pastor. So I was assigned to Our Lady of the Assumption Church in Claremont. Claremont is in the far eastern part of the Los Angeles Archdiocese. They say it's the land of trees and PhDs because there are five colleges plus the graduate school and the school of theology, and there are lots of trees. And I met wonderful people there. I was very involved in youth ministry. I celebrated the youth mass each Sunday at 5 o'clock. I had a great experience there. Then an opening came up to be a pastor of Holy Name of Jesus Church, which was in South Los Angeles. That area used to be referred to as South Central Los Angeles, but after the Rodney King riots, businesses were hesitant to invest in South Central, so now it's just South Los Angeles. Very active, dynamic parish, 80% African-American, 20% Hispanic, big gospel choir that sings every Sunday, Hallelujah in the Sanctuary. I mean, it was a great, wonderful experience. It's in an economically challenged area. It's in an area that has a lot of gangs and drugs and violence, but an incredible sense of spirituality of the people in the parish. I had 9 years there as pastor, and then this past July 1st, I became the pastor of St. Mark in Venice, which is just about a mile off Venice Beach. Very different environment, but still a wonderful community. Venice has its share of homeless people and also has some interesting characters like the chainsaw jugglers down in Venice Beach. But what I found is, again, a great sense of spirituality and a great opportunity for me to meet God's people and serve.
Well, what would you tell a guy now, a guy of any age, really, but particularly someone who was like we were in our early middle age, who has had thoughts in the direction of the priesthood? What would you tell him about that today? What would you tell him to expect?
Well, the first thing I would tell them is to concentrate on your prayer life. No matter where your life goes, as long as you have that great prayer life, that relationship with God, God will always lead us in the right direction. Then I would get to know some priests and talk to them about their priesthood. What have they found rewarding? What have they found challenging? And then I would contact the vocation directors with the diocese and say, you know, this is something that's been in my mind for a while. I'd like to talk to you about this. What's the next step? When I did that, they encouraged me to get a spiritual director. I had a sister of St. Joseph, Sister Esther Palacci, who was a wonderful spiritual director. She helped me to see God's will in my life. And then, as I said, I went to the monthly discernment group meetings and the retreats. And the idea of learning as much as I could, discerning it, and then really asking the Lord in prayer, what are you calling me to?
Well, Father Paul Spellman, one fantastic priest, a diehard Trojan, knows more about classic rock and roll than anyone. Paul, many thanks for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Patrick, it was great. I hope everything continues to go well with the radio program, and I hope you have a great source of listeners to see where God is leading.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott.